Good morning. I welcome you all to chapel to worship this morning. I want to introduce first off our guest speaker today, David Radcliffe. He's from Peoria, Arizona. Is that right? Or okay, yes. and we go way back. When I was a youth growing up, I heard David speak at annual conference, Church of the Brethren annual conferences. Summer camps, youth retreats, and on and on. And he really encouraged me to put my faith into action. And so he's one of the support systems that I had when I was deciding to come into seminary is some of my memories that I had with him. So I wanted to bring him to the campus so he can share a little bit of the ministry that he does. He has been a pastor. He's worked on the general board for the Church of the Brethren and also directed the Washington office for the Church of the Brethren. And now he is founder and director of a new community project, which does a lot of things. There's information on the back of the bulletin. But he advocates for human justice, eco-justice, and earth care, and now a lot more social justice and things like that. And so I just wanted to say a few words about some of the things that he does. And one of the great experiences I've had was that I got to go to Ecuador with him in 2008 for, what was it, about 2 weeks. And we went and lived with indigenous people in the Amazon. We saw rose plantations. We saw sustainable farming. We saw oil drilling, deforestation, a lot of different things that opened my eyes up to how I impact people around the world that I don't even see. And so as we welcome him and as we are turning our focus to worship this morning, I ask that we stand as we sing the first hymn and turn our worship into song. Thank you. I'll be reading from the Gospel according to John, chapter 13. Now, before the festival of the Passover, Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. The devil had already put into the heart of Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, to betray him. And during supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, got up from the table, took off his outer robe, and tied a towel around himself. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus answered, "You do not know what I'm doing, but later you'll understand." Peter said to him, "You will never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no share with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head."
Well, it's great to be with you this morning. Peoria, Arizona, it's a little chilly here this morning, I'm just going to say. We feel your pain, though. Out in Arizona, it dipped down to the 60s last week. Should have seen people running for their winter jackets. I'm David Radcliffe, with the New Community Project. Call ourselves a small nonprofit organization with a big goal to change the world. I'm guessing that's part of your mission statement as well. We're a network of about 11,000 people across the U.S. We've got partners in 6 countries around the world. We have sustainable living centers, one just 5 minutes from here, Main Street in Harrisonburg. Some of you may have visited. Also, we just launched another one in a foreign land, Vermont. And so they're trying to embody the things that I sort of say they practice what I preach. And so they're putting into practice kind of things that can be done in one's community, in one's household, and not just personal virtuous actions, as I'll talk about a little later, but also reaching out to the community beyond to see how we can change some of the systems that control the way our world works. If my name sounds a little familiar, the Radcliffe part, maybe you've heard of Daniel Radcliffe. Yes, the Harry Potter kid. My son's name actually is Daniel Radcliffe. We had the name first. My son's older than that little punk. So, plus he wanted to be an actor too. So there went his stage name right out the window. So now he's working for Chase Credit Card Services. Anyhow, I know a little bit about your neighborhood. I grew up in Botetourt County, just outside of Roanoke, down that way from here, about 100 miles down the interstate. I attended Bridgewater College, over the hill and through the dale from here. I have known and worked with Mennonites, really all through my career. First as the peace officer for the Church of the Brethren General Board. I got to know your staff with MCC and the peace office there. Then with same time with New Call to Peacemaking, and you would have had collaborators as part of that team that worked at that initiative in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then as recently as last month, our learning tour to Nepal, we stopped in at the MCC office there just to see what you folks were up to and up to good things, I just have to tell you. I can tell you more about it in the chat talk on later if you'd like to know more. I too was once a seminarian, as I assume are most of you this morning. I got a Master's of Divinity from Bethany Seminary, and then our Church of the Brethren Seminary, then went on to get a D.Min. in Peace Studies from the same place, and was a pastor for a decade before I saw a small notice in a Heifer Project mailing advertising an experience in Central America called Hunger and Justice in Central America. This happened back in the fall of 1986. I called them up. The group was full, but they took me anyway, and it changed my life. You see things, as you know, you've probably done much more travel than I had done at your stage in life, but you see things in a place like that you hear about in Sunday school, but you think you're never going to encounter. Hunger, poverty, human rights affliction, U.S. imperialism writ large on these small nations in Central America. Well, one thing led to another, and then almost 13 years ago, which is hard to imagine, I and some others founded New Community Project. And I've already said a little bit about who we are and what we do. Promoting environmental sanity. We know not what we do with God's earth, or at least we care not what we do. Just one little indicator of the mess we're getting ourselves in. There are half as many living creatures on earth now as compared to when I sat where you sat in my seminary classes. From the seas, from the skies, from the forests, from the fens, they are gone by human hand, one way or another. We also work at peace through justice. As you well know, we will not have shalom, peace, without tzedakah, justice. And Hebrew scholars, forgive my pronunciations. So we work at capacitating women, educating girls, standing by ethnic and racial and native communities in Southern Asia, East Africa, the Amazon, the Arctic, and out in Arizona, where I live, when settlers, and what a benign word for what all that entailed, when settlers first arrived in that part of, you can't even say the new world, it was an old world to a lot of people, you know what I'm saying, in that part of our world, there were people living there, surprise. The Odom people were one of the groups that lived in our part of Arizona, a riverine culture, small communities, irrigation projects to irrigate their small kind of projects there, and hunting and gathering through the area around them. Basic, but, an okay lifestyle. Then we took their rivers away. It wasn't long before they started to actually perish. Well, we got to feeling all guilty about that. Well, we did not guilty enough to redirect the rivers. Well, we start sending them government surplus food, white flour, white sugar, cooking oil. Now the Odom have the highest rate of diabetes in the world. So from a subsistence healthy, quote unquote, not modern, but a subsistence healthy lifestyle to one that none of us would envy. And even today, the Apache people and others see sacred land out there in one particular corner just to the southeast of Phoenix area where I live, called Oak Flats area. The government, our senators, swapped it away, or tried to swap it away, to an Australian conglomerate for copper mining. And the Apache and others said, whoa. And they occupied the little campground there. My wife and I went to visit them. And just finding ways to stand by people like this on the margins. And as Mennonites, you know something. You've been marginalized, as have we in the Church of the Brethren. You know what it feels like to be on the outside looking in. And so now hopefully we have a certain affinity for people that are on the outs with the global economy, global society, global culture, fighting for their life, really. Cultural life as well as real life, we might say. And here in Harrisonburg, some of our colleagues just walked in the door. Here in Harrisonburg, we, as I mentioned earlier, we have the Sustainable Living Center, again, just a couple minutes away by car and a few more than that by bicycle, which these guys came on by this morning, I think. They're reaching out to the discarded, the disenfranchised, to young people looking for the meaning of life. And there are a lot of them out there. They're looking for a place to call home. And I mean a real home. And the third part of our work is what you seminarians might call transformation or even conversion, in the sense of turning in a new direction, turning into a new creation. You know all the language. We attempt to do this through what we call experiential learning, offering opportunities that challenge and change people, whether by coming to our sustainable centers here or up in Vermont, going with us on a learning tour as Gabe did down to the Amazon or the Arctic or some of the other places that we're involved, or me coming and doing my little song and dance. Just getting people thinking about this world they live in, their responsibilities for the way it is and for the way it could be. Thinking that as we are changed, we then become agents of change. Now, I really get tired of all those, including in my own denomination, the Church of the Brethren, for whom that first step is all there is to the matter, that we be changed. And it's often even less than that. We don't really need to change anything except our hearts. Seem to be what a lot of people are saying. That didn't seem nearly enough for our Lord. You remember when he said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" Nor for two writers I've been reading lately, Gernot Wagner, his book, But Will the Planet Notice, Derek Jensen, What We Leave Behind, both of whom disparage personal change and personal virtue. Jensen actually singles out Mennonite communities. And I think he's thinking the horse and buggy variety, thinking that if they believe that this is really making some impact on the world, they are naive and irrelevant. Because, as Wagner says in his book, people even like himself, growing some of their own food, taking public transit, recycling scrupulously, buying fair trade. It won't make a difference, he says, if 7 billion people are going the other direction. So they're challenging our efficacy, not just our faithfulness. And I have to say, you know, their solutions. Jensen saying tear it all down and build it back up with the health of the ecosystem as your marker, whether this is a successful project or not. And Wagner saying that we need to work within the system to bring change. I even emailed Wagner. I was leading a workshop down in Roanoke a few falls ago on climate change. I said, what am I supposed to tell these people? You know, because we all like to say, here's the things you can do in your household to change, you know, or your seminary building or whatever. And he said, well, he wrote me back and said, well, A, buy my book. B, form affinity groups of people who care about the things you care about. And C, then begin to impact the systems within your reach. Well, I want to challenge both these writers, actually. Neither of whom give much credence to individuals taking things, matters kind of into their own hands, making the changes that we all feel like we personally need to make. And I want to ask them, where's the spark? Where's the kindling? Where's the energy? Where's the spiritual vitality for these big changes you're talking about going to come from? From politicians? From green corporations? From big green environmental and other kinds of organizations? I think not. They're in too far to see out. So this is where I think people like you and I come in. And if we, of course, we can't stop with the personal transformation. It has to move out from there. Otherwise, we deserve the criticism they offer us. And I was, just to give you some idea of how important what we bring, James Speth, former White House science advisor, forestry professor at Yale University, writer of books including Red Sky at Morning, some other environmental things you might be aware of, was meeting with a group of church leaders not long ago. And he said to them, I used to think that the, why can't I read my own writing? I used to think that the most important problems facing our world were global warming, environmental degradation, and ecosystem collapse. A fair list. And that we scientists could fix these problems with enough science. But I was wrong, he said. The real problem is not these three items, but greed, selfishness, and apathy. And for that, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. We need your help. Speaking to this group of church leaders. This is where we come in. And that's why I'm grateful for the seminary education that I have, even though my life has taken quite a different course than I thought it was when I was sitting where you're sitting. And not just the people skills, the preaching classes, nor learning about administration and fundraising at the Church of the Brethren offices where I worked for 15 years, but the reframing of reality to see that we need an entirely different approach if we're going to successfully and or faithfully address the issues that face us in our world. I mean, and I believe that's that kind of approach is promoted by our kinds of seminaries. One that reminds us that we approach the world, whether the creation or the human community, with an attitude of humility and respect. And in a strange way, our scripture today is a reminder of this. We read this story from near the end of Jesus' life, where he turns and washes the disciples' feet, and Peter objects, and Jesus says, no, it has to be this way. Now, in the Church of the Brethren, we think of foot washing, it's about as close as we get to a sacrament. Because we see it as sort of the supreme symbol of serving, bending down, face to foot, washing another's feet with our hands. Even though we've all scrubbed our feet and donned clean socks before we show up at foot washing, there's still something about it that reeks of servanthood. Bending, bathing, being willing to do for others. Jesus even follows this with the command, as I have done, you do. And yet there is this twist to this foot washing in our text today. Jesus not only commands that we wash, but that we ourselves be washed, to be served, to give others the opportunity to do, to offer, to be the one with something to give in the relationship. Now, this isn't all that easy for us, as you know, at least on two levels. First, we've all been taught that it is better to give than to receive. Jesus probably even said that somewhere. It's almost hardwired into our self-concept of Christians that we need to be on the giving end rather than on the receiving end. And frankly, in a society like ours, where the operative mantra is me more now, we can use a little or a lot of other-centeredness, future-centeredness, holistic-centeredness. So how does Jesus' insistence on Peter and the others, disciples, letting him wash their feet fit into this? We could say it's just a sacramental understanding, some sort of spiritual cleansing. That's sort of how Peter seems to be interpreting, wash all of me then, I really need it. Except that Jesus says just after this that he's given them a very practical example of servanthood. If I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, then you must. Another way to understand Jesus framing foot washing here, no, that's not what I said. I had an even better term. Another way to understand Jesus' fancy footwork, that's what I really meant to say. Another way of understanding Jesus' fancy footwork here is to recognize that there is actually a serving component to allowing oneself to be served. In doing so, we are seeing the other person as the actor, the one who initiates, the one who has something to give, to do for us. That in some way elevates them. There's a certain authenticity, a certain, someone with something to give, has certain feelings it generates in oneself, and gives them the power and the status of the one who is the instigator, the one who is in a way in control as the server. In other words, I'm wondering if part of the allure of being the servant in our typical understanding of the word allows us to be the ones calling the shots, setting the terms, the one with something to give, and then receive the accolades. We have a solidarity worker program at New Community Project. We take internships at our local sites in Harrisonburg and Vermont, but we have solidarity workers we are willing to send abroad. Maybe a little like your SALT program, for what I know about the SALT program, I'm not sure. Where primarily these young people are seconded to our partner organizations to just work alongside them, to fit into what they're doing and try to, we want them to have something to contribute and to do what they're asked to do. This coming summer, we're hoping to send a team to South Sudan. And I've been receiving applications, including one from a young woman who stated in no uncertain terms that along with whatever she might learn or receive from the people she'd be working with, one thing was for sure, she wrote, she'd give to them more than she received from them. She wanted that to be clear. She was going over there for the balance sheet to be in her favor as the one who had more to give. Really? And I had to, think about it. She hasn't even been there. She doesn't know the dynamics, who's giving and receiving, for one thing. And B, why was this so important to her? Did it have to do, ironically, with our need to come out on top as the servant? This attitude of needing to be the giver who is in control also shows itself in large aid programs. Our partners in the Southwest Delta of Myanmar tell about a Christian agency run by the son of a former famous evangelist, I won't say any more, who, when it came time, when they come into the area to do their ministry, ask for or expect little from the local communities. They know, they kind of know everything they need to know when they go in. And in one instance, donating to the grateful villagers, which is, I'm sure, what they wrote on the reports back home, teams of water buffalo, which were unfortunately freshwater buffalo, not suited to the saltwater environment of the Delta. I wouldn't have known that. They didn't either. They didn't bother to ask, many of which large creatures perished in the process. Of course, after the aid group went back home, wrote their reports. And our friends, they could have told us, our partner group there, the little Baptist group we work with, but they said they treated them like the hired help. So along with the disrespect and the disrespectful attitude this conveys, of course, it's also a waste of somebody's good money. And the people feel bad because these animals kind of died on their watch, even though kind of wasn't their fault. Of course, we like to think we never act like these big agencies. And what I know about Mennonite groups, this is not your style. One of the biggest, I don't want to say credits that we ever received as an organization was down in the Amazon a couple of summers ago, gave a summer or two after you were there. Delio, who you know, the Siona shaman who guides us, is our friend now after, 10 years of going down to his community and letting him guide us through the forest and talk about the culture, the realities, etc. He had a little ceremony for us a year or two after you were there, Gabe, and he said, he used the word animar, but I think animated, excited, enthused, whenever you come to see us, you don't tell us how to dress, you don't tell us how to arrange our families, you don't tell us what we can and can't do with our medicines. And he handed me a paddle. He said, I feel like we're paddling together. That's kind of what you hope for in your relationships in this world with partners in different places. But even we, Christians who practice appropriate community-based development, what does it mean to allow our feet to be washed by those who we feel like we ought to be serving, to put the shoe on the other foot, so to speak? That's the last one of those I'm going to use. I'm not sure I have the answer for this, but several possibilities present themselves. Taking our cue from Jesus and his encounter with the blind man, you remember the guy crying out by the road, everybody telling him to shut up. Jesus said, tell him to come here. He hops up and comes over to Jesus. And the first thing Jesus says to the guy is, what do you want me to do for you? Sorry, Jesus, this is a blind man. What do you think he wants you to do for him? Jesus had the respect for this guy to let him set the agenda. You know, blind people are more than blind people. Might have been other things at issue there for this guy. A volunteer in Guatemala tells a story of an agency that came through local villages installing composting toilets, which the people gratefully received. What else could they do? And once the organization was out of sight, turned them into very expensive chicken coops, which is what they really needed. But nobody bothered to ask. And we can also take an even riskier approach of allowing our neighbors to ask the questions. Because you ask the questions, you set the agenda. You control the flow of the conversation. You're the one interrogating in the harshest way to frame that. You're the one interrogating. They're the one simply on the witness stand responding. Put ourselves on the witness stand. Allow them to ask the questions. This reminds me of a little of Jesus and the Canaanite woman who came asking him to heal her daughter, whom he initially turned down, saying he came only to the house of Israel, not to pass the good stuff to the dogs. And you remember the woman came back. Don't the puppies get the crumbs? We invite others to help us set the agenda for our relationship at our peril. They may ask of us things and to do things that put us and our preconceptions on the spot, even our Lord's. I remember being in a Salvadoran community with a group of campesino farmers, people whose livelihoods were being jeopardized by the importation of cheap, subsidized grain from the United States. Free trade. Subsidized free trade. I asked for their thoughts on the situation, and one poor farmer gave us a 10-minute lecture on the perils of globalization and then closed it all by saying, but what do I know? I'm just a poor campesino. I said to this guy, you know more than 95% of the people where I come from because you are living through this. And you can see that this kind of analysis from our global neighbors, when we allow them to ask the questions, to make the analysis, puts the pressure back on us to get our own house in order when we come there trying to bandage the wounds inflicted by global currents rather than stopping those upstream, unleashing the dam waters. Which reminds me of a woman I heard speak at a pastor's conference in Pennsylvania a few years ago. I believe her name was Rebecca Todd, and I think she's an author. The internet wasn't working at the house I was staying at this morning when I really had a moment to look that up. But anyway, Rebecca Todd, she had spent time in Kenya as a student Christian volunteer of some sort. As she prepared to end her service, she promised her host that she would go home, complete her education, and then come back to see how else she could help them. At which point, her host suggested that, and this takes courage for the host to suggest to a rich worlder in your community. At which point, her host suggested that the biggest assistance she might offer them is to stay at home and work to reform the system that was causing them so much grief. So are we willing to listen to what our neighbors really are asking of us, what they really need from us, rather than, you know, what often feels like the feel-good approach? We allow our neighbors to wash our feet when we allow them to be the ones to set the tone for the relationship. Here I use allow, the verb allow. It is an unfortunate verb that we find ourselves having to use in this situation. After all, in economic, social, political, cultural terms, we are the ones in power. We have the power to allow or disallow. An unfortunate circumstance that we find ourselves in as rich world Christians and in rich world societies. How can we ever truly serve our neighbors when we come from this position of power? Or are we reduced to doling out the crumbs from our largesse? When, where, and to whom we choose, for which they will be grateful, at least to our face. What choice do they have? Now, Jesus kind of had an answer for this predicament as well, as Paul writes in Philippians 2, not considering equality with God a thing to be grasped, he humbled himself, taking the form of a slave, which, by the way, we typically translate servant, because we like the tone of servant a lot better than we like the implication of slave to our world, to our neighbors. Anyway, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, in other words, he became one of us. That sets the bar pretty low, as it were. Do we dare become like our neighbors, which may imply a radical downward mobility? Or, barring that, be so willing to defer to them as the ones fully capable of washing our feet that we are left with little room to take credit for what may finally emerge in our relationship? I don't have all the answers to this, and maybe in our little talk bond thing here or later at the luncheon thing, whatever, we can get to the bottom of some of this. But I would like to defer in closing to one much wiser and more experienced in these matters than myself, your dean. Just kidding. Which you probably are, but I didn't. Last spring, I met Balbir Mathir of the nonprofit Trees for Life, which some of you may have heard of. After knowing his work for years, I finally got the chance to actually meet him face-to-face in Church Fellowship Hall in Wichita, Kansas, where he's Indian, as in Asian Indian by birth, but has lived in Wichita for, I guess, most of his adult life. And I was very impressed by just our short interchange, the things he had to share about his approach as his organization has dealt with, in many ways, with the poor world and trying to find ways to work together towards something better. So I asked him then if he would write the back page of our newsletter. I call it The Backyard Fence, Conversations About the New Community. Get on the mailing list if you want to, out on the table out there. But so I asked him if he would write the reflection on the back page there, and here's a little bit of what he said. We never seek to improve the disenfranchised out of pity. Rather, we long to connect with them at a place where we can explore the potential that emerges from our union so that we may grow together. Also fundamental in our approach is to helping people is to shift the paradigms that create and sustain the cycle of poverty. Our business model, he said, is concentrated on finding the trim tabs. Now, I had no idea what a trim tab was when I first read what he said. Evidently, the trim tab connects with the rudder and makes the rudder turn, which then in turn moves the whole ship. So once you control that small, evidently, trim tab, you've got access to the rudder, you've got access to the whole enterprise. Anyway, our model is to find the trim tab, which turns the rudder, then the ship. Certainly affecting social behavior in complex and entrenched societies is very difficult and time-consuming, and most people want it on the cheap. Most development organizations want this on the cheap. But where was I? Complex and entrenched society is a very difficult and time-consuming. But once it is done, moving the trim tab is a piece of cake. And that is when we get out of the way. Let me say that differently. That is when we get out of the way and make room for others, allowing them to lead the way. We did that with our Moringa Tree program. You may have heard of, has incredible health benefits, this Moringa Tree, but largely unknown a few decades ago. We helped start a social movement, and people worldwide joined in, took up the cause, and now there's over 200 million planted, he said. Next, we will focus on the trim tab of enabling qualified teachers around the world to share their skills with those who serve the poor, as a major burden in the poor world is a lack of well-trained teachers. At the root, he concluded, we see ourselves as the servants of the servants. Simply helping our collaborators in the field find the tools they need to build this better world. How do we move aside, or at best, move along with others to empower them to also do what we have so enjoyed, washing the feet of our world and ours as well?
Thank you, David. This call involves the international and the political and the local and also the transformation of our own souls. David has brought up a lot of different themes here, and I invite you now into a time of reflection. We'll have an opportunity for conversation with David during lunch, and you're all invited to that. At this point, though, take some time on your own. If there are comments or themes that you would like to speak as well, I invite you now into this time of reflection.
Thanks for being here, and I think you have some very important messages for us. When you were talking about Derek Jensen, I had a thing go off in my head. I happened to have met him and talked to him, and I have to say, I was not impressed with his philosophy, particularly his calls for violence in defense of the earth. I think that kind of thinking is exactly the opposite of what we need to do with the earth. And I think that one of the reasons I really like your call as an Anabaptist is that there's a peace witness in it. And I see a lot of hope in that, and I see a lot of hope in Anabaptists acting as agents of ecological change. There's a conflict in the Hutterites right now about Monsanto and these industrial farming practices, genetically modified stuff. There's a conflict on that in the Amish community that I know of. And I think that the real kind of change that we're looking for that maybe Derek Jensen isn't aware of when he critiques Mennonites is that when we actually act as Mennonites, as good Mennonites, when we take our own message of Galassenheit seriously, that we can start to be agents of that kind of change that the world is going to need if, you know, there's not going to be a 10 degrees rise in global temperature and nothing will ever survive that. So the only hope I see for the world, this is somebody who's been invited like to be in an eco-militia, and as somebody who's in the army, like the only hope I see for the world is in Galassenheit, in the spirit of Jesus.
Thank you, David, for speaking this morning. I think one of the things that really resonated with me was this sense of deep anger that I sense within you. You talked about three of the things that you feel like are really kind of pivotal. Greed, I don't know what the second one was, but the last one was apathy, and self-centeredness, yeah. And I don't know, I think that there's something about that deep anger that's really dangerous, but it's also kind of hopeful. And I think somehow we'll have to tap into that kind of that sort of anger if we hope to be about transformation of our world through Jesus. Thanks.
Question for you, David. After affirmation of both what you've said and what Evan and dear friend, I forget your name, and Phil have said, EMU, Eastern Mennonite University, is working on ways to move toward carbon neutrality. One of the challenges is what's realistic. And yet realism seems not enough to get us to where we need to go. I mean, business as usual, and I think this is part of what we were hearing from you, is a pretty scary place to be. How do you wrestle out realism in terms of current structures and technologies and attitudes and what's going to need to happen so radically for any of our visions to really bear fruit? And I say that with affirmation, but worried.
If you want to give some comments now, go ahead, and we can also continue this same topic in the lunch.
Since he put it right to me, I'll go ahead and just say a little brief something. I think we have to be fully aware of the realistic situation that we're in. I think that itself takes courage to look into the heart of darkness that we face. And I think most people are whistling Dixie, and they're headed straight ahead without thinking much about this. So I think it's a real gift simply to look at the reality of the situation. And then the trick, or the grace, is to keep hope alive in the midst of that. And I find that, I mean, for myself, I find about looking at what my friends are doing here in just down the street from you, what institutions like maybe yours are doing for your own carbon neutral actions. I look around the world and see my friends there who are up against all kinds of things that we can't, you know, we don't face in day-to-day life, whether it has to do with the environment or social structures, economics, whatever they may be, and yet they find a way to move ahead, even simply just living purposefully in the face of all the things that they encounter. So those things keep me, it's hard to say, I guess I can say hopeful. I'm not optimistic, but I remain hopeful. I think, as you said, I think it'll take a miracle for this to turn. But I'm not sure we can discount miracles, and I don't mean from necessarily beyond, but I mean the beyond infused into our lives, into our consciousness, working through us. That's where we have to be willing servants, because if we're not willing to be used as fully as the divine and our best nature calls us to be in this situation, we are really in trouble, because I kind of also don't know where else this is going to come from. So I try to balance those things out, and I knew some environmentalists I've heard have turned to lament. They simply go out to the desert and gather with people who knows we're going down the tubes, and they sing dirges, you know. And in some ways, you know, there's some place in the Bible where that happens. The people are away. They're in exile, you're lamenting, that's all you can do in the moment. And I'm not totally against it. There's a sense of reality-based therapy there somehow, I expect. But that's not enough for me. And I hope I'm not just naive. I hope I'm grounded in something deeper, as hopefully we all are, that can take this through our hands, out of our hands, to a land that not even we maybe can imagine at this time. And if that fails, we have to walk along with those who are struggling to be there in the midst of the despair. I mean, that also can be a ministry. So I hope we're ready for whatever comes, hoping for being bold enough to hope for the better world.